The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Thank you all for coming this morning. When I was a young novice, a very young novice, my master, Reverend Master Echo, decided that we would revive a tradition that comes from Japan of having our master write on our small kesas some teaching that he had for us, and then he would sign it with his name and seal it with his monastic seals, which are his name, his religious name in Chinese characters. So he asked all the novices, and those of you who are here who know this story, I may have it wrong, but this is my memory. He asked all the novices to make a new small kesa and to bring it to his house. And one evening, we were all, I think there were 8 or 10 of us maybe then, we were all called down to the monk's common room in the far end of the property here and asked to wait there. And one at a time, we went over to his house, which is the building next door, and got our small kesa. And I had a sense of a great deal of anticipation at this event because I was going to get this special teaching that my master had for me. And I went into the room and bowed, and he gave me the small kesa, and I read it. And it said, "Great doubt is the womb of the Tathagata. Great faith is the child of the Lord. Great doubt is the womb of the Tathagata." Tathagata is an epithet for the Buddha, so the womb of the Buddha. "Great faith is the child of the Lord." And I read that, and I had not a clue what it meant. And furthermore, it didn't seem to have anything to do with me, because though before becoming a monk, I was really cynical and skeptical. I thought that I was so certain about being a monk that I had put all that down. So I couldn't understand why he was accusing me of great doubt, which was how I saw it. So I wore that on my body for some years, contemplating what it might mean. Maybe a year or two later, my master began a sentence to me that began with, "The gravest mistake I've ever made." And of course, my ears shot open. Here was my master telling me about the mistake he had made. And he said, "The greatest mistake I've ever made was to doubt." And that caught my attention. Again, what does doubt have to do with me? What does doubt have to do with our training? Now, many of us are familiar with doubt as the fifth of the 5 hindrances. The Buddha taught that there are 5 hindrances to success in training, and they are desire, hatred, sloth, and torpor, which I just love, sloth and torpor. That's one. That's the third. The fourth is restlessness and worry, and the fifth is doubt. And I recently came across a quote that is attributed to the Buddha. Apparently, he said, "There is nothing more dreadful than the habit of doubt. Doubt separates people. It is a poison that disintegrates friendships and breaks up pleasant relations. It is a thorn that irritates and hurts. It is a sword that kills." That's pretty damning. It's a sword that kills. So this fifth hindrance was obviously something that the Buddha was quite concerned about. Now, I myself, this is the doubt. I call it obstructive doubt, the doubt which is a hindrance. And I myself had an experience of this doubt as a young postulant and novice when I would think to myself, sometimes often, "Well, I can always leave." And the idea was, in spite of my conviction that I was meant to be a monk, there was always this out that I left for myself. And I began to notice that well, you know, if things got bad enough, I could go somewhere else, I could do something else, I didn't have to be here doing this. I began to notice how undermining this was, that I was always entertaining the possibility of something else, and that really distracted me from dealing with what was right in front of me and with the real issues of my training and of my own mind and heart. And one day I decided I wouldn't entertain that doubt anymore. I just decided to stop, that when it arose, I would drop it, and I wouldn't give it fuel. This was a way of closing off any exit, so that I had to focus directly on what I really needed to deal with in my training, by not allowing my mind to have free rein with doubt. And it really allowed me to settle into my practice, to be content, and to train more deeply. And this was the real thing. This doubt was preventing me from training deeply. It was keeping me on the surface of things because I was constantly getting waylaid by it and not, as I said, dealing with the real issues. Now that's obstructive doubt. At some point I came across, actually Reverend Master Daizui, the second head of our order, had a Chan retreat at Fugen Hermitage, in which we studied, I happened to go to this retreat, we studied the Wadu, the great doubt. Now this is a Chinese Chan practice. It's not part of our practice per se, though much of what it deals with is related to our practice. Wadu is H-U-A-T-O-U, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right for the Chinese in the room, but that's how I understand to pronounce it. This means the great doubt. So here was the great doubt on the back of my small kesa with capital G, capital D. And there's a modern Chinese master, very fine master, named Master Sheng Yan, who has written a book called Shattering the Great Doubt. Lovely title. And in it, he describes this practice and how to train with it. And I'm going to say a little bit about it because I think it will be illuminating for us. If you find that you must go do this practice, I would advise you to get a teacher. Don't read his book and just do it on your own. Wadu practice is related to the koan practice that we find in Japanese Zen. It's the practice of taking a short sentence, a short phrase from a koan story, from the whole story, and using that phrase in one's meditation practice. And Sheng Yan's favorite Wadu is, what is Wu? And Wu is the Chinese word, which in Japanese is Mu, which comes ultimately from Shunyata, and it means something like nothing, no, not, emptiness. So what is nothing? You know, the question that creates, that raises a pickle that you can't really answer with the thinking mind, and that's the whole point, is to undermine the thinking mind. And I'll read you a little bit of how Sheng Yan writes about this because his writing is quite eloquent and to the point. He says, just keep asking the Wadu, what is Wu? And you ask this question over and over again. You sit down in meditation, you ask this question over and over again, and you don't let it out of your mind. You keep your focus on it with great concentration, without wavering from it. Just keep asking the Wadu and pick it up when wandering thoughts arise. Eventually, you will truly be investigating the Wadu. At that point, what we call the doubt sensation will arise, and eventually, it will evolve into a great mass of doubt. When the great doubt is shattered, you will have answered your Wadu. This doubt does not mean skepticism or suspicion. And this is part of the point here, is that this great doubt is not this obstructive doubt. It's something else. It's another kind of doubt that arises in our training and can be used as a positive tool for our practice. This doubt does not mean skepticism or suspicion, but an intense uneasiness and wonderment that we must know the meaning of the wadu. We must know the meaning of life. It is a state of all-consuming questioning that is relentless, not settling for any solution other than the complete resolution of the wadu. Such resolution means liberation from the great matter of birth and death. Liberation from the great matter of birth and death. Naturally, there are degrees of doubt, from momentary feelings of a fleeting doubt sensation to a persistent undercurrent of the doubt in all of your daily activities, to a great doubt sensation where you feel your whole world has collapsed into this sense of intense wonderment. When the doubt reaches a crescendo, it becomes vast and self-sustaining. Under certain circumstances, this great doubt will explode. Your sense of self will suddenly vanish, and enlightenment will occur. And he says, there is a saying, great doubt, great enlightenment. Small doubt, small enlightenment. No doubt, no enlightenment. That is, the depth of any realization will correspond to the power of one's doubt. So if my master was accusing me of doubt, maybe, and I say accusing, that's my word, I'm being facetious. He wasn't accusing me of doubt. But if he was pointing to doubt in me, and doubt that I needed to come to terms with in my training, maybe that was a good thing. Great doubt, great enlightenment. Maybe I could use that fruitfully in my training. So the whole idea here with wadu practice is to maintain a continuously questioning mind, a relaxed mind, but with great urgency asking the question, what is the truth of it? What is it? What is it? What is the root of my own existence? What is the root of vexations of self-clinging? Sheng Yen uses this word vexations for suffering, and I think it's a really great way to translate it. You know, all those little vexations that are sometimes deeper suffering than real suffering? Wanting deeply to know the truth. Now, the important point here is that what happens is that we become the question. It even can occur that wu drops away. I mean, Sheng Yen says, drop off the what is wu and just say wu, wu, wu with this deep questioning. But even the wu, what if the wu drops away and we just become a question mark and our whole being is asking, what is the meaning of it all? I think of the movie What's It All About, Alfie. We enter into a state of wonderment of not knowing and urgently needing to know, wanting to know. The answer to this question, whatever that question is, becomes the most important thing in our lives. And it turns out that we can't provide the answer. That the practice is to allow the wadu to provide the answer, because any answer that we try to provide won't be it. Now, as I said, this is a Chinese Chan practice. It's a very fine practice, but it's not part of our tradition. Our tradition teaches that the koan arises naturally in daily life. Many of you are familiar with this phrase. The koan arises naturally in daily life. So what does this mean? It means that daily life presents us with training, inevitably, and in spite of ourselves, and no matter how perfectly we try to be. And ultimately, daily life presents us with that which is our deepest spiritual question. And that question will be different for each of us. For me, it often takes the form of, is it possible to love universally, unconditionally, and without attachment? Now, like the wadu, what is wu, there's this paradoxical element to it, that kind of paradoxical element you find in Zen koans. How can you love without attachment? How can you love universally Think of all the things I don't love. I hate, you know, it's shocking. So the question contains this element of paradox. For others, the question might take the form of, in the face of the mess the world is in, how can I avoid despair? Or how is it possible for me to save all beings? We take a vow, however innumerable beings may be, I vow to save them all. How is that possible? How can I, little old me, save all beings? Or what do you mean there's no self? I'm here, aren't I? I mean, look at me, right? Something like that. Isn't it clear that I'm really here and alive? Or if Buddha nature is everywhere, why can't I see it? Or if all beings are Buddha, why is there so much evil in the world? Or Dogen's question, if we are already Buddha, why do we have to train? So each of you will have your own question of this sort, something that arises for you that is fundamental to your being and disturbs you over and over again, that sometimes you find a response to, and then that response will fade away or you forget about it, and then the question arises again. So as in Wadu practice, the question permeates all of our lives. And if we train with it really deeply, we actually become the question. Again, we become the question mark. And our very living is the question. It's the living out of the question. So this great doubt, which Sheng Yen talks about, which is part of Chinese practice, comes to us in terms of this koan, in the koan arises naturally in daily life. And really, this is a very deep and profound form of investigation. And I think the word investigation is a helpful one. It may shift us from that sense of negative or obstructive doubt, doubt which is a hindrance, to ways in which doubt can arise as a very positive force in our training. And investigation, by the way, is one of the 37 factors of enlightenment. So it's one of those things that moves you towards enlightenment. So it must be good. So part of what I'm trying to say here, maybe the crux of what I'm trying to say, is that it's okay to ask questions. That in our training, asking questions is a good thing. And in fact, is not just a good thing, but it's essential. And it's really what we truly are. It's somehow fundamental to who we are. Now, we don't always want to ask questions because asking questions can rock the boat, upset the apple cart, open Pandora's box. You know, life's kind of okay. And if we start to look at something too closely, it can be pretty dangerous. Like, well, what is it that makes me a monk? Well, I'm not a monk because I'm celibate. I'm not a monk because I wear the robes. I'm not a monk because of any of the forms that pertain to monasticism. I'm not a monk because I say a special verse before I eat. That kind of question can completely undermine me, and I say, okay, I'm out of here. Or it can drive me way deeper, and I can investigate at a deeper level what it means to be a monk. Now, that's an example that comes from my own life, and each of you would have your own form of it. So, but my point is that asking questions in this way can be very, very dangerous. And we can avoid the asking of these questions because we're afraid to, because of the arising of fear, even terror, that looking at these things might actually be so unsettling, the answers so disturbing, that it will somehow set us off on a course we didn't want to have to take. You know, taking the precepts can be like this. Should I take the precepts? You know, maybe the answer is no, because my life's okay as it is, and if I take them, who knows where it'll lead? You know, following the precepts where the blood of the Buddha leads, taking the precepts can change your life. So you have to be careful about these things. But I'm obviously recommending that when we find ourselves asking questions that we're afraid to ask, that it can be very fruitful to actually turn towards the question and look at it as, and investigate it as deeply as we can. You know, the other possibility is that you ask the question and you come up with nothing. You know, you ask about the mess that the world's in and how can you avoid despair, and you end up with despair. That can be frightening. Is there another place? So this asking of questions is really the way that we, a way, that we can deepen our practice very profoundly. And I call this way of asking questions the great doubt, or the fruitful doubt. The great doubt, which is the womb of the Tathagata. So this began to give me some insight into this teaching that was on the back of my small kesa. Great doubt is the womb of the Tathagata. Now again, it's important to distinguish the mind of obstructive doubt from the mind of great doubt. The mind of small doubt, if you think of yourself when you're doing that doubting, that's deleterious or negative. Well, deleterious is a great word. That doubt is angry, complaining, whining. You know, you're whining, why does it have to be this way? Angry, complaining, whining, tense, small, suspicious, undermining, deleterious. And as I said, I like that word deleterious. It's got delete in it. You know, we delete from our being that which is helpful to us. So that's the mind of small doubt or obstructive doubt. The mind of great doubt is relaxed. And Sheng Yen says that it's the relaxation part is essential. And I think it's easy to forget that. In our great efforting towards enlightenment, we can forget to relax. So the mind of great doubt is relaxed, open, wholehearted, spacious, generous, grateful. It's also searching, inquiring, investigating, exploring, curious. Searching, inquiring, investigating, exploring, curious. Isn't this a wonderful possibility that we can be explorers in our spiritual path? That it isn't done and finished, that there are new frontiers that can open before us as we ask the questions that we ask. So this heart mind of great doubt allows us to take very difficult questions and very difficult circumstances and explore them with gentle kindness and friendliness, as the Shirangama Sutra says. Or as one of my novice masters says, with gentle curiosity. We can take that which is difficult and that which is most meaningful to us and explore it with gentle curiosity. Now, an example of the difference in these two minds, I think we've already kind of made this plain, but consider the novice monk, and I'm picking on monks today for some reason, but consider the novice monk who goes to the novice master and says, why the heck do I have to live in the meditation hall? I hate it. It's a lot of trouble. It's inefficient and hard. That's small doubt. That's obstructive doubt. That's undermining doubt. But the novice who goes to the novice master and says, living in the meditation hall is really hard. Could you help me with what the teaching is in it for me so that I can deepen my practice? That's a question that comes from great doubt. So we can shift this in ourselves when we become conscious of the whining mind that doesn't like things the way that they are. We can just shift the way we're asking the question. And you can see how that second way of asking the question leads to real teaching and learning and deepening of our practice, while the first way undermines us getting anywhere. It's important to remember, I think, that when we make our being into a question mark and our lives become a question mark, that the answer is always unstable. That the answer is not exempt from anicca or impermanence. You know, I have this tendency to think, aha, now I've got it. And a week later, I've completely forgotten it. It slipped away, and I'm starting over again. And the answers that we come to may serve us for an entire lifetime. And yet, as we move through our lives, the emphasis we place on things will shift, and answers will arise that have other wordings or other ways of speaking to us that will show us other facets of the jewel of training. And those answers are, that shifting of the answer is important. Otherwise, we freeze ourselves, and training becomes boring and monotonous, as do our lives. So it's important not to become attached to an answer, to hold it lightly, but to hold it deeply, and let it go when something else comes to fill its place, so that we don't ossify and become kind of frozen and dull. So I thought I would just give you my current answer to the question. But I preface it with, anicca, impermanence. And by the way, this is a way in which impermanence is our friend, right? This year I'm turning 60, and some of you have heard me say this already. I don't usually pay too much attention to birthdays, but for some reason this one stopped me. The question arose, your life is 3/4 over. It may be more over than that, but for the sake of argument, let's just say my life is 3/4 over. Have I spent it well? What's needed now? That's the question that arises. And the answer that keeps coming back to me is that now that I'm 60, I ought to retire from suffering. From vexation, anxiety, worry, the sense that I'm never good enough, all the inadequacy, all those things that create suffering. And of course, that's easier said than done. But what I'm finding is that I'd like to spend the rest of my life enjoying myself. Now, that can sound pretty superficial in the context of Buddhist training, and we know that enjoyment is always fleeting. But I think it actually runs deeper than that, because it means enjoying myself even when it's anxiety or pain or suffering that's arising. And I'm finding more and more that there's some way of engaging with the present moment, with what is right here, right now, in this moment, that allows this enjoyment to arise, even when what's arising is painful. It's actually more painful to turn away or to ignore or to pretend it isn't there. Now, that may be a bit of a digression from what I'm talking about, but that's part of the answer to my question. Have I spent my life well, and what do I really want to do now? So it's become very important for me to engage in the present moment and, in effect, inject joy into it. Inject is a little too hard a word, but enjoy, bring joy into it, or see the joy that's already present in it. It's also become extremely important to do whatever I can, and I shudder to think how well you all know I fail at this, but to do everything I can to be kind. I was actually thinking of Jizo, whoever true kindness would find should come here. The first line of that last song or invocation that we sang. So there's kindness. And then it occurs to me to remember that I know for sure from my own direct experience, my own wonderment, my own questioning, my own great doubt, that the ground of the mind is clear, bright, awake awareness. And that this awareness pervades the whole universe. It is what all things are made of, and I mean all things, not just humans. This is the glue, which is the love, which holds the stars in place, as I've said before. This awareness is completely and utterly still, and yet it flows. The ground of the heart is the functioning of this mind of clear, bright, awake awareness. The doing of this mind. The ground of the heart is the flowing of compassion. The flowing of awareness. The flowing of awareness which is compassion. Bright, awake clarity expresses itself in the world as compassion. So this is the current answer to the question mark of my life. This is the great faith which is born from great doubt and which is the child of the Lord. Great faith is knowing that we are fully endowed with Buddha nature and that we're all capable of enlightenment. And I'm not even sure I'd call it a child, even though obviously we're baby Buddhas and we've all got a long way to go. I wouldn't call us baby Buddhas because this child is a Buddha, is Buddha, and Buddha pervades everywhere and isn't so small as to qualify as a baby. The gravest mistake I can make is to doubt this. And you all know this too. Thank you.